Eternal God, our Father, who art far above our highest thoughts, but very near to us in moments of worship, we praise thee for the heritage from the past, the opportunities of the present, and the hope of the future. We pray, our Father, that thou wilt come to us as light to guide us and as power to sustain us. Come to us through minds that are open to thy truth. Surprise us with joy and prepare us for Christian ministries on a high level of competence and of kindness. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. We are glad and grateful that our guest lecturer today and for tomorrow is Dr. Stuart C. Henry of Duke University. Dr. Henry earned the A.B. degree with distinction at Davidson College, the B.D. degree at the Louisville Presbyterian Seminary, and the Ph.D. degree at Duke University. He is professor of American Christianity and director of studies in American Christianity at Duke Divinity School. In 1966, and 67, he directed graduate studies in religion at Duke University. Prior to his work at Duke University, he taught at Southern Methodist University, and it is notable that he was voted most popular professor by the undergraduates of the Southern Methodist University in 1958. Dr. Henry is a creative scholar, an outstanding teacher, an excellent writer. I am grateful for this opportunity to thank him for his Christian scholarship, his devotion to theological education, and his great love of God and neighbor, and to introduce him to you. After the anthem, Dr. Henry will speak on the subject, the artist as historian.
Oh, Dr. Binkley, I thank you for your gracious introduction. That grace has always characterized my too infrequent relationship with Dr. Binkley. I remember very gratefully that it was thanks to his intervention and endorsement that when I went on a sabbatical 7 years ago, I received a grant from a foundation which enabled me to do so. This is one of several things that I remember gratefully about your president. It's also been my real privilege to work with Dr. Carlton and Dr. Shriver, many of your faculty members I know and regard as friends, and so for many reasons I am exceedingly pleased to be here today. One thing that impresses me continually as I grow older is that we cannot make old friends. So I'm increasingly grateful for the old friends I have. The incident is recorded in the book of Joshua. A band of wandering nomads comes boiling out of the desert, and under the direction of Joshua, shadowy figure to us, but substantial to them, begins to claw a foothold into what they are pleased to refer to as their promised land. Whatever vacillation or uncertainty there may have been, there was no question that once they had crossed the River Jordan, there was no turning back. Bloody encounter lay ahead of them, and possible defeat. Here was a time of truth. So when they had crossed over the river, the thundering words of Yahweh commanded them, "Take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from every place where the priest's feet stood, and carry them over with you and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. And when your children shall ask you in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? You shall tell them. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever." Now here is the challenge and the difficulty of the historian. How does one keep the memory of the past green in the minds of youth? How does one choose the place at which the altar will be built? Why not an altar at the edge of the Sea of Reeds? Why here? For obviously the matter was important to the Hebrews, important enough that there are two different accounts of the building of the altar with a stone for each tribe. Two different accounts are preserved for us and woven together so that there seem to have been not one but two altars, one in the middle of the riverbed and one at the edge of the river, one at the site of the bivouac. Now, just how does one best identify and preserve that residual wisdom and beneficence so that generations perhaps not born and certainly not mature will accept and benefit from it? To put it differently, suppose that in addition to being epistles of grace, as you certainly are, you had also the privilege and the obligation of composing today a document which would preserve and hand down, marked and revered as those stones by the river, that which in our own generation merits remembrance out of all the welter of phenomena and statistics which are embraced by the phrase religion in America. What would you choose to put in your letter to the world if it were your privilege? Too often the details that we select convey nothing significant. They no more signify the importance of what is happening about us than do the great collection of our photographs and slides communicate the impact of what we have seen on a world tour. It's one thing to visit the pyramids, and it's quite another to try to explain their grandeur and mystery to our neighbors, their witness to history, by showing our friends a snapshot of ourselves, smiling in the Egyptian sunlight and standing against the fuzzy focus of three triangular blurs in the background, here are the pyramids. No, not at all. The fact is that we do not always know how to represent what we have experienced. An older friend of mine, of recognized, if solemn, wit, was at one time at great pains to explain to me that when she was a young girl at the turn of the 19th century, that people who lived then did not think of the times as gay, nor of horses and buggies as essentially charming. So go to then. How would you describe this age? What detail? What arrangement? So that in days to come, your children, looking at what you have left, would ask, what is the meaning of these stones? With the answer already, as it were, given to them in terms of what they see, the solidity of the stones, their sacred number, their altar form, their place of location, details converging toward the knowledge that Yahweh must surely have appeared in this place and with power. You see, I am beginning by asking, how does one write history? And especially, how does one write the history of the church, the history of the faith, if we may join the terms together? Now, admittedly, this question suggests a challenge that is rarely met. But in the days that we have together, I hope to speak to you of a part of the problem, of one aspect of the task in terms today, of a kind of person who does successfully write history, and tomorrow, of the kind of person one must be in order to write history effectively. The man I speak of today is the artist, and I cannot say what I want to say of him without first speaking briefly of the meaning of tradition. For it is, after all, the tradition that the historian discovers and defines and hands to another. It is not inappropriate to use the metaphor of handing over the tradition, and that is what the word means, passing from one hand to another, much as the ball is handed along on the field of play. It is not always easy to follow. Sometimes the ball is fumbled. Sometimes a man will take the ball and run in the wrong direction. And sometimes, and we need always to remember this, just where the action is where the ball is not. And this happens with tradition. But one must never confuse tradition with the heritage. And let us make this distinction first. Now, the heritage is conglomerate. The heritage includes everything. When you begin to speak of the heritage of the Christian church, there is matter enough to reduce the most hardened sinner to penitence simply by contemplation of the grace made manifest, or to supply Hollywood, as indeed has happened, with more than is tasteless and violent than even her shoddy merchants might be willing to sell. For the heritage includes everything. There are not only the simoniac popes, those wretches whom Dante pictured head downward in stone pits with flames dancing on their feet, but there is also the gentle Thomas a Kempis, about whom little is known, but nothing remembered that is not pervaded with the spirit of one who continually practiced the present. In the heritage, there is the outrageous, near unforgivable hanging of the witches in Salem Town, and also there is the picture of Samuel Sewall, most respected and secure of all the patriarchs of Massachusetts, standing with head bowed in the midst of meetings, while the unsolicited and unexpected confession of his guilt in the trial and his anguished conclusion that the madness of Gallows Hill was a sin against God, while this is read aloud to a stunned congregation. For the heritage is like that. It is conglomerate. Wheat and tares have been curiously and inseparably sown together in our past. And it is the duty of the historian to separate the wheat from the tares, Not, of course, by refusing to admit that the tares are there. Who can deny that at times St. Paul is arrogant and maddening? But by presenting and representing the past in such a way that the tares appear for what they are, and the wheat as wheat. For if the heritage includes stories of ignorant and dotish monks, it includes also the stories of those patient brothers and monasteries who worked diligently in their cells, striving to copy and preserve and keep the chronicles, when the light of learning sputtered and almost went out. They alone stared at the sky with inquiring eyes, tending the last embers of a glory that had once illumined the earth, and the first of a greater glory to come. Saints and sinners, wheat and tares, Ananias as well as Abelard, all these lie behind us in the story of the Christian heritage. But the historian must transmit the tradition. And as the heritage is conglomerate, the tradition is selective, highly selective. For what the tradition must do is to embody and express the essence. It must make plain the true meaning. It must represent the vitality. Let me give you an example. In the heritage from the Franciscans, there is a collection of literature and less about St. Anthony of Padua, he who is now the patron of lost property because a novice who ran away with a psalter which St. Anthony was using was forced by an apparition, an army apparition, to return the stolen property. Chiefly, however, the stories about Anthony center in his ability as a preacher, as a strong spokesman who proclaimed the word. Suddenly called upon to preach at an ordination at Forli, he did so with such eloquence that he was summoned to a place where he might use his gift effectively. Or again, denied the right to preach to men, he preached to the fishes. And I cannot forbear to tell you that he explained to them that of all of God's creatures, they ought to be most grateful to him. Because when, on the occasion of the deluge, the whole world was the object of God's wrath, they alone were privileged to visit in kings' palaces and to see mountains and trees. But these stories, appealing all, accurate, not quite, these stories of the heritage, the tradition that rests therein, is that in the 13th century, when much that the heritage tells us was unfortunate at best and positively blasphemous at worst, even then there was the tradition of a strong and vigorous proclamation of the gospel, less loud than the clamor of the Fifth Crusade, less official than the disputatious gathering of the Fourth Lateran Council, and sometimes lost in the noise of the reveling clerics, all of which was going on at the same time. Even then there was the tradition of the announcing of the good news, of heralding with no uncertain sound the coming of the kingdom. Now then, when you set yourself to the business of preserving the tradition, when it becomes your task to consider all the wealth and the welter of the heritage, and from that vast and complex body to select out of all the details that emphasis, that motive, that symbol which embodies and typifies the tradition, so that one can say to another, here, take this and guard it and pass it on to those who follow after, then you are trying to discover the meaning of Christianity. It is not the tradition, we say, of this which we hand on, but it points to the tradition. The power is indicated here. There is an indication in what we hand over of that residual benevolence which sustains and thrives in the Christian community and which instructs us in the essence of the way. Now, the historian must speak of details in such a way that one remembers not that St. Anthony preached to the fish, but that the grace of God was not unspoken in the early dark days of the corrupt 13th century. That is transmitting the tradition. You will, therefore, easily understand, I hope, that now, well into the matter, I announce my subject, namely the artist as historian. For the artist does indeed commit the tradition to others precisely by offering a creation, a painting, an aria, a ballet, which must be seen in a certain way to be understood, but which, once understood, can never be forgotten or ununderstood, no matter how hard one tries. There is this peculiar characteristic of truth, once we have seen it, in the sense that the writer of the fourth gospel speaks of see to understand, we can never unsee it. And this is what the artist does in passing along the tradition. He gives you a detail, he gives you a creation that makes you know and makes me understand the tradition. Now, the artist does not take facts literally, nor present them literally. To do so would make him quite dull. He may very well present a truth with quite deceptive detail. For instance, consider the familiar painting remembered from the kindergarten days of our childhood, that of George H. Broughton of Pilgrims Going to Church. Critics are quick to reassure us, and you remember the picture, that the firing pieces are wrong, the style's inaccurate, the terrain unauthentic, and yet, although it is of a style no longer bogus, there is something that the artist does here which performs the work of the historian in conveying to us something of the tradition. What is handed along here in the almost too representational offering of men and women making their way through the snowy New England woods is the dedication of a folk whose zeal, it is true, was not unalloyed with pride. The dedication of a folk who considered it no small thing to follow their conscience, even to the point of forcing their conscience upon the conscience of others. Yet their determination is plain to see in Broughton's canvas, and their serenity in the face of the weather-beaten woods and thickets, which Bradford, in his History of Plymouth Colony, assures us they found after their hazardous journey across a vast and furious ocean. This lets us see that the tradition of Plymouth is caught in the brushstroke. We know instinctively the answer to the question which Bradford raises. May not, he asks, and ought not the children of these fathers rightly to say, our fathers were Englishmen which came over this great ocean and were ready to perish in the wilderness? Yes, we see it in the painting. Perhaps no one in England knew where they were at this time, but they remembered that God knew, and that was enough. And we see this, and the artist has preserved history and tradition for us in showing this to us. Now, at a more sophisticated level, both of understanding and certainly of artistic excellence, there is a magnificent portrait of Paul III, one of several painted by Titian, which represents the worldly old pontiff at the age of 75 in conversation with his nephew. It hangs in the National Museum at Naples. The face is both intelligent and cunning, and there is there the inner tension of one who had character without morals and intellect without wisdom. In the 400 years since the time the artist has trapped this face on canvas for us has not erased this circumstance. Paul is pictured with two of his nephews, Ottavio and Alessandro, and it seems as if he regards them already with suspicion, as if he anticipates the future rebellion and revolt from members of his own and openly acknowledged family. It is equally believable that this Pope welcomes musicians and buffoons and female singers and dancers to his court. No spoils for tea. Equally understandable that he should have welcomed them, and again, that this was he who encouraged Michelangelo and embellished the Vatican with the Sala Regia and the Cappella Paolina. But it is at this point that the artist fulfills the role of the historian. For here, if you will, for all to see, is the irony and the tragedy of the papacy of the 16th century, recorded by the artist in the face of a Pope who stands between the Renaissance, which he loved, and the Reformation, which he could neither understand nor forgive. So does the artist ever, with no regard for facts, and with great care for all the facts, represent to us the truth of what has happened in the past, so that we consider a painting, or hear a concerto, or read a poem, or contemplate a statue, and all at once know something, even a great deal, about another time. But there is more to be said. The artist is not simply expressing an idea, he is representing a vision. And moreover, he is doing it in such a way, and this is the important feature, the artist is representing a vision in such a way that his vision is apprehendable by the populace. His skill actually makes it possible for his vision to become ours. Michelangelo's Pieta is an inexpressibly moving statue of the Virgin Mother holding the body of her dead son, speaks to us so that her gentle face, untorn by agony, calm in grief, tranquil in resignation, says all that need ever be said about the tragedy and the redemption of life. We identify with the artist. His tragedy and his experience are our tragedy and our experience. And when he speaks to us of other days, his past becomes our past, and his history our history. What I'm endeavoring to say is that the transmission of the tradition, in this, the artist is the servant of history, and that this is true because he refines from the heritage the vision from which the tradition takes its life. And he speaks of his vision in such fashion that it becomes our own. Now, up to this point, I have spoken of illustrations rather arbitrarily chosen from painting and sculpture. The whole range of the scale of art is, I believe, susceptible to this kind of interpretation. And yet time would fail me to tell you of composers and builders and poets and dancers who, through their craft, have not only spoken truth but have taught history. So I want, therefore, having defined the principle, to give you a somewhat extended example of how I believe it has worked in our generation. The Cathedral Church of St. Michael, Coventry, is old, even by English standards, and by ours, very old. It begins with a monastery endowed for an abbot and 24 monks in the 11th century. Although richly ornamented and impressive, the church was essentially a monastery, so that it fell into bad taste in the days of Henry VIII. Her income was given to another, her resources were plundered, the lead was stripped from the roof, and the walls were used as a quarry for stones to build bridges and houses. Yet, miraculously, like the phoenix rising from the ashes of destruction, St. Michael's rose again. So that, thanks largely to the generation and devotion of wool merchants of Lichfield, it was built once more. That it should be accorded cathedral status seemed altogether proper when it was so designated in the early part of this century. And then, on the fearful night of November 14, in the year of our Lord 1940, the incendiary bombs of Hitler's airmen reduced the cathedral to rubble. Archie Howard's description of what happened bears the unmistakable distress of one who seemed to see tradition dissolving before his very eyes. Towards 8 o'clock, the first incendiary struck the cathedral. Soon the whole interior was a seething mass of flames, and piled up blazing beams and timbers, interpenetrated and surrounded with dense bronze-colored smoke. All night long, the city burned, and her cathedral burned with her, emblem of the eternal truth that when men suffer, God suffers with them. Yet the tower still stood, with its spire soaring to the sky, emblem of God's overruling majesty and love. The artist does speak to us. By early morning, the destruction was complete. Every roof was gone, and the whole cathedral lay open to the sky. The matchless pillars, arcades, and clerestories of the nave, chancel, and aisles were lying on the ground in long piles of broken masonry. It was as if 1,000 years of natural decay had come upon the cathedral in a single night. And that was by no means the end of the matter. As the morning grew, wrote the prophet, and a pale sun caressed the ruins, sounds reached us from the stricken city. There was the sound of cranes and hammer and shovel cleaving new arteries, the sound of voices shepherding evacuees, of the rhythm of workshop and factory. The people of Coventry were piecing together their shattered homes. They were already making a new future, strengthened by the ordeal which they had shared with their beloved cathedral. And so it was that the prophet confessed that as he went into the ruined cathedral on the morning after the destruction, there flashed into his mind the deep certainty that as the cathedral had been crucified with Christ, so it would rise again with him. It was 14 years before the reconstruction of the cathedral was begun, and a deal more time before it was finished. But it is finished now, consecrated by the Bishop of Coventry in the presence of the Queen in 1962. And since that time, it has become an attraction for millions of visitors who are drawn to Coventry by more than curiosity. Here, if you will have it, is living truth that the artist is historian. First of all, there is the miraculously risen sanctuary itself. It joins the grandeur and the splendid ruin of the former cathedral, the old with the new. The new building connects with the wall of the old and the ruined church so that the architect speaks the continuity between the two. The dependence of the present upon the past, the inseparable union between today and yesterday, even when we are reluctant to admit it. Moreover, because the new cathedral is erected on a north-south axis, in order to effect this connection between the new structure and the ruins, it happens that the liturgically east end of the cathedral is geographically the north. Our history, particularly our religious history, has a way of reorienting us. New occasions teach new duties. Time makes ancient good untruth. New occasions teach new perspectives. There is a parable here, and the artist has laid it out for us. That juxtaposition, however, is but a part of the artist's lesson. Within the ruins of the old cathedral, there is an altar surmounted by a charred cross which was fastened from the beams salvaged out of the burned ruins. There is also a smaller cross constructed of nails discovered in the rubble of the older church. Everywhere without, as one approaches the new structure of pink sandstone, there is the history of Christ's church, the phoenix rising out of the flames, the church eternally reborn out of the dust and ashes of human frailty, while the kingdoms of the Caesars have been reduced to dust and ashes and blown away. Built on the instability of Simon Peter, the doubt of Thomas, the dullness of Philip, the church has lasted. The kingdoms of the Caesars, built on strength, have dissolved and disappeared, and one hardly remembers their date. Once inside, the visitor, who may very well discover himself to have become the worshiper, encounters other lessons writ large upon the walls, that is, if he has eyes. Here is faith for the future. For you see, it is one of the functions of the historian to define the tradition not alone in terms of showing us where the power has consisted, but to do so in such a fashion that he discovers, uncovers to us, the direction in which the tradition points. Tradition may often make use of what custom has isolated, but when the tradition is in danger of being identified with custom, then the historian must warn us and jolt us into new conceptions of the true nature of tradition. It is at this point that the artist, perhaps, performs the greatest service in making us see what the tradition truly is. He defines it in a new idiom, which speaks the ancient truth, but which at the same time, by saying it in a new way, frees us to hear the voice of the future for the response to whose bidding tradition exists. Thus the artist breaks with custom to show us a Jesus of the people in a film about St. Matthew's Gospel. And the rift frees the tradition from the shackles of custom, and at once brings us closer to the history and nearer to the possibility of the end of history. Of that, more tomorrow. Meanwhile, consider the interior of the cathedral and how now here indeed the artist has acted as historian, even though the break with custom in the style is undeniable. For the building is a modern building, a contemporary. Nowhere is the break with custom and the unity with tradition more evident than in the great tapestry which hangs on the east wall of the cathedral. It is at once the reredos of the high altar and also of the lady chapel. One sees the hanging immediately on entering the cathedral. It is dominant and arresting. The tapestry depicts Christ enthroned in glory and surrounded by the symbols of the four evangelists. Carries the main burden of an emotional impact, and it establishes a mood to which the whole interior is subordinated. The technique by which the tapestry is woven is very old, but the symbols, harshness. The colors appear harsh. The figures which represent the four evangelists seem at first glance to be distorted and crude, and there are folk who have found it completely resistant. Yet the very break with custom jolts the visitor into seeing that the doorway into heaven, which is the truth the tapestry is meant to show, was never an entrance into that which is subdued and quiet and lifeless. This is not what heaven is. Now, it was one thing to build a cathedral in the 12th century of England's life. At that time, all men were religious, conventionally, never mind that their morals were bad. Conventionally, they were religious, even if they were wicked. All men were, for the society was built upon a sacerdotal basis. The Crusades, chivalry, schools, the guilds, all were geared to the church. But in our generation, when men are no longer deeply religious, at least not conventionally, to build a cathedral is to be eccentric. This is the work of an anachronist. Yet at Coventry, the artist has come to the service of history, particularly the history of the church. For working with Sir Basil Spence, the architect, artists of various nationalities and talents have together brought a kingdom into being in conception and a cathedral actually, and it is not anachronistic. It is a symbol of the tradition, a word to the generation that the generation hears and understands. Almost miraculously through art, not only through the tapestry, but through the stained glass and the mosaic and the sculpture and the masonry, having time to discuss it, through all these media, there is almost unbelievable richness, but never with more effect than with the great tapestry, and always with definition and underscoring of the tradition. They have contrived to make relevant this day in our own day a cathedral which ought by all canons of logic to say nothing to us, and it speaks to our very heart. But it does, and what it says through the creation of the artist is captured in that verse upon which the designer of the tapestry actually drew inspiration for the creation. Holy, holy, holy is God, the sovereign Lord of all, who was and who is and who is to come. And this is the essence of the tradition. That which was has vitality now and leads on to that which cannot be destroyed. Our history and our tradition, though we sometimes require the artist to tell us so, are encapsulated in this phrase: the strength of the past is the strength of today. Thus the artist is a historian, or he can be, when he discovers to us the essence and the direction of our tradition, the tradition that so much more selective than our heritage is the residual benevolence of all our past, which becomes the light of our existence and the beckoning voice of our future. Let us stand for the benediction.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace, both now and in the light everlasting.